Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Tom Cruise has become the very public face of the Church of Scientology this summer, but he has plenty of company in Hollywood. Kirstie Alley has been a member for more than 25 years. John Travolta, 30. Cruise's fiancée, Katie Holmes, is reported to be the latest Hollywood star to join the church's ranks. Scientology is based on the teachings of its founder, science fiction writer L. Ron Hubbard, author of Dianetics. His book offers a path for shedding negativity, Scientology teaches, for achieving happiness and success. So why are Free Katie t-shirts such a hot item on the web? Well, this church has its critics for rejecting psychiatry as a science and mental illness as a disease, for the cash members pay to advance in the faith. Time magazine famously called Scientology a global racket, yet members say the church means everything to them. Here's Tom Cruise on the Today Show.
And it is a religion because it's dealing with the spirit, you know, you as a spiritual being. And it's something that there's tools that you have that can actually, that you apply to your life.
Tonight on Point, the Scientology buzz, L. Ron Hubbard's universal vision, and what makes a faith a religion. You can join the conversation. Have you listened to Tom Cruise on a Scientology role? What do you hear? And what draws so many celebrities to Scientology? Has Scientology drawn you? We're at 1-800-423-TALK. We'll hear tonight from observers of Scientology, some sympathetic, some not. We thought we had a minister from the Church of Scientology lined up for the show. He finally declined to join us, but Scientologists, you are welcome to call in. 1-800-423-8255. We begin tonight in Los Angeles, where Scientology has its West Coast headquarters. James Verini wrote the first in a four-part series called Summer of Scientology for the magazine Salon.com. He joins me now. James, thanks for being with us tonight.
Sure. How are you?
Well, great. So tell us, what turned your head at Salon.com in such a huge way? You've got all kinds of ink here spilled on Scientology. Why so much? Why now?
Well, I only wrote the first part. I'm not sure what the editor's thinking was in terms of why they put the whole series together. But clearly, it's been in the news a lot lately, and Tom Cruise has, inadvertently or not, made it a very public issue. It's been a public issue in one way or another for a few decades. But no one has really sort of been as outspoken about it as he seems to have been in the last few months.
You've sort of meditated on what Tom Cruise is depicting here with his very public professions of Scientology insights this summer. How are you interpreting this very big star's very big kind of, I don't know, marquee about Scientology this year?
What I learned from people who've studied the church and former members, was what they were speculating was that Tom Cruise's sort of newfound proselytizing and general exuberance seemed to suggest to them that he had reached a new level of the church. As I say in the article, the speculation was that he'd reached OT7, which is basically the penultimate level in the church's hierarchy. It's a point at which you have basically learned how to shed your mortal confines. You know, the Scientologists believe that, you know, we are souls and that our bodies are these temporary vessels, and you've sort of purified yourself, and that you're uniquely capable of helping other people do the same. So you can understand that if somebody is convinced that that's happened to them, they would, you know, they'd be as exuberant as he seems to be.
So this is a very, very high level of Scientology achievement, you're saying, in Tom Cruise's case.
Yes, it takes years. In his case, I guess about 20 years since he joined the church around 1986. That seems to be about standard, so far as I found from my sources, to reach this particular level, 15, 20 years. Some people take 30. It's been done a little quicker than that. It requires hundreds of hours of their coursework and what's known as auditing, which is their counseling, the counseling facet of their, and also lots of reams of knowledge, if you'd like to call it that, of the of L. Ron Hubbard's cosmology and his various theories about social behavior and biological history and evolution and everything. He was kind of a self-styled polymath in that way.
James Freeney, if you'll stand by for a moment, we want to begin to get the voice of L. Ron Hubbard in this conversation tonight. There are excerpts from his lectures on the web. We pulled a couple down today, and we just want to have him as part of this. Science fiction writer, author of the book Dianetics that Scientologists read and study. And here he is, just a brief excerpt from one of L. Ron Hubbard's lectures. Let's listen.
I admit that some man occasionally will become afraid and will become totally gripped by the belief that there is menace in every fellow man. I admit that a human being can become so aberrated as to constitute a menace to the bulk of the society. And that in such a case, it is necessary to reacquaint him with society. But I will not admit that there is a naturally bad, evil man on earth.
L. Ron Hubbard, founder of the Church of Scientology. James Verini, Tom Cruise is, what, 42 now? If he joined 20 years ago, he joined very young, and he is, as we've said tonight, clearly not alone in Hollywood, never mind beyond Hollywood. What's your, you're there in L.A. What's your sense of what seems to make Scientology so attractive to any number of very high-profile entertainment folks in Hollywood?
I think there are a number of interesting answers to that. First of all, it has a very prominent physical presence in Hollywood and Los Angeles. This, along with Clearwater, Florida, this is, you know, its home base.
There's a big kind of French chateau-looking hotel in Hollywood.
Exactly, that's actually right down the street from where I'm talking to you right now. Their Celebrity Center. Spelled in the French way, center. And, they have a very prominent physical presence, and they give over a lot of thought and expense to aesthetics. So their outposts, like on Hollywood Boulevard and elsewhere in Hollywood, are very, flashy and sort of attractive to the eye.
We know Hollywood likes flash, but surely it's more than that that's drawing people like John Travolta and Cruise.
Oh, definitely.
And...
Well, I think going back historically a bit, L. Ron Hubbard, he wrote reams of what are called technical bulletins and other internal memos for his church members. He wrote a whole series on PR, how to present the church publicly and how to groom its image. And he explicitly, directed the church to seek out the support and membership of celebrities and artists. He called them at various times opinion leaders, opinion makers, because these people wield a unique influence over the rest of the population. He realized that, and of course, he was right about that, and he encouraged their recruitment. I think
we see why the church would want them. Yeah. Why do entertainers come to the church, to Scientology?
For the people who join, Los Angeles and the film industry, entertainment industry generally it's an extremely difficult business, it doesn't boost anyone's ego who works inside of it. Entertainment is famously insecure or people. Mm-hmm. So I think it provides the promise of a certain amount of security, solidarity, and it provides the opportunity for self-help. Its immediate appeal is that the church can help you overcome your inhibitions, your personality flaws. It promises that all of these things have sort of answers that you can eventually get over whatever is holding you back. That's the entire sort of the mythos and the image. The whole volcano, which is on the front of Dianetics, was L. Ron Hubbard's main image for this idea of self-actualization and sort of, eruption from one's confines. And that's it's a very, seductive sort of promise. We can help you get over whatever's holding you back.
And you write that Tom Cruise, this summer, with his at least reputed ascension to this high level of Scientology, OT7,
right.
Apparently feels empowered to speak out on all kinds of things now.
Apparently, yeah. Principally, it's been psychiatry. That seems to be his main you know, whipping post.
What's Scientology's problem with psychiatry?
That's a very complicated question, probably stemming originally from L. Ron Hubbard's own experience with psychiatry. He had some run-ins with psychiatric evaluation, and his wife, who filed for divorce in the 1950s, suggested, or I think even stated outright, that he had been recommended to be committed by doctors for possible schizophrenia. But their stated objection is that there's no such thing as mental illness, that chemical imbalance is a myth, that what we think causes depression or anxiety disorder or indeed dyslexia in Tom Cruise's case or ADD, these are all things that are can be gotten over by being audited and by addressing the sort of past traumatic events in one's life or in Scientology, previous lives.
James, we're going to look into all of this tonight. Salon.com has reported on how hard Scientology has been on publications and reporters who have been critical of it. Have you had any repercussions from what you published recently?
No, I haven't. I haven't had anything happen.
Okay, well,
thankfully. And I live right up the street from them, so they wouldn't even have to get in a van to come get me.
Right, they know where you are.
They could just walk to my house, yeah.
James Arini, stand by. There's a lot more we're going to learn tonight. We're talking about the Scientology buzz, about L. Ron Hubbard's vision of the universe, and what makes a faith a religion. You can join us tonight. Have you listened to Tom Cruise on a Scientology role? What do you hear? What draws so many celebrities to Scientology? John Travolta, Kirstie Alley, Lisa Marie Presley, Greta Van Susteren, and Beck? And have you been drawn to Scientology? Has it worked for you? Has it put you off? Let us know. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Scientology buzz, about L. Ron Hubbard's vision of the universe and what makes a faith a religion. You can join us tonight. What do you make of Scientology's sharp attacks on psychiatry? Have you been drawn to Scientology? Has it worked for you? How? Has it put you off? Why? And who's to judge what's a good religion and what's not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Actor Tom Cruise has been very front and center this summer, talking about Scientology and his beliefs out of the Church of Scientology. Here he is from an exchange. We were talking about his opposition to psychiatry and antidepressants. Here he is talking with Today Show host Matt Lauer. This is on Friday, June 24th, criticizing actress Brooke Shields for taking antidepressants.
Here's the problem. You don't know the history of psychiatry. I do.
Aren't there examples, and might not Brooke Shields be an example of someone who benefited from one of those drugs?
All it does is mask the problem, Matt. And if you understand the history of it, it masks the problem. That's what it does. That's all it does. You're not getting to the reason why. There is no such thing as a chemical imbalance.
Tom Cruise on the Today Show, leading with his chin. James Verini joins us tonight from Salon.com. He's the author of the first of a four-part series on Salon called Summer of Scientology. We're joined now from Madrid, Spain, by Stephen Kent. He is a professor of sociology at the University of Alberta in Canada. He's written extensively on the Church of Scientology and has testified against the church in court cases. Stephen Kent, thank you very much for being with us. I know it's late there.
Oh, yes, Tom. Thanks for calling.
And with me in the studio tonight, Susan Setta. She's professor of philosophy and religion at Northeastern University, looks at newer religions. Susan, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Stephen Kent, I wish you'd take us to the basics here, to the heart of Scientology. I don't know the best place to start, maybe with the creation story. It gives us a sense of how L. Ron Hubbard came at unspooling this story. What is the Scientology creation story, Stephen?
Well, the creation story to which you're probably referring is a story that Scientologists only get after years of study and paying tens of thousands of dollars. Some people say hundreds of thousands of dollars. You're probably referring to the basic OT3 story, the operating Thetan story. We can talk about this story, but because so few Scientologists actually hear it, the bulk of Scientologists who move through the world and who are involved in the organization are not centering their lives around this story. It's the aspect of the group that's attracted a lot of attention, but it really doesn't help us get at the core of what Scientology is.
Fair enough. I take your point, and we'll go right beyond it, but give it to us just now that we've raised it so we can have a sense of what kind of thing people are studying when they reach OT3.
Sure. Yeah, more or less, the story says that 75 million years ago, there was an evil warlord over an overpopulated galaxy. This evil warlord's name was Xenu or Zemu. Xenu tricked his overpopulated planets, took these people and put them in spaceships similar to I think DC-3s, sent them to a planet called Tigiak, which is actually Earth, sent them actually into volcanoes and exploded those volcanoes with H-bombs. The resulting souls that were left were terribly confused, and they attached themselves to bodies throughout time. What the upper-level Scientology OT3 or OT documents attempt or claim to do is to give people the power to remove those clusters of so-called body thetans that have attached themselves to people and to their bodies over the eons of years and lifetimes and rebirths and so on.
And you're saying thetans, that's T-H-E-T-A-N, these are these confused souls, I guess.
That's one interpretation of them. I've seen different definitions that Scientology gives.
That gives us a sense of one angle, one line of the teaching. You say that's not really the core of it. How do you describe the core of Scientology, Stephen Kent?
Well, there's different ways to define Scientology. One perspective is to talk about it as a multifaceted transnational organization, only parts of which are religious. That is to say, the religious dimensions of Scientology would involve claims about past lives and lives on other planets. There are, of course, however, pseudo-medical claims, some of which we've heard Tom Cruise give. A lot of people may not realize that the foundational book of Scientology called Dianetics was based upon the non-germ theory of disease that L. Ron Hubbard put forward. This so-called theory postulated that 70% of human illnesses were psychosomatically created, hence auditing could cure a wide range of human illness.
Now, what's auditing? I've heard that word a couple of times this evening.
Oh, yes.
Auditing.
Well, you'll hear different interpretations about what it is. Scientologists would say it's spiritual. It's a spiritual counseling of some sort. Critics would say that it is a form of pseudo-counseling and also a form of Scientology ethics training, that is to say of getting people to adopt a particular worldview that has Scientology at its center. So there are many different kinds of auditing. Some is just verbal. Some of it's done with people holding on to cans attached to a particular device called an e-meter. E-meter is supposed to only be used for religious purposes, but there are numerous occasions in Scientology where the e-meter becomes something akin to a lie detector.
And what is an e-meter supposed to do?
Well, Scientologists would claim that e-meter has a meter on it, and Scientologists would claim that in the auditing process, certain words or people returning to certain events gives indications on the meter. And when that needle stops jumping around and starts floating, it indicates that the negative event that a person was recalling no longer holds sway over that person.
So Scientology is described as a kind of process of cleansing oneself of, I don't know, something like bad karma, bad souls from eons ago through a series of training stages?
That's part of it. But, of course, the early kind of pseudo-counseling with Dianetics. Now, keep in mind that the foundation book was called Dianetics, the Modern Science of Mental Health. The early claims of Dianetics do not necessarily involve past life claims. They would go back as far as the womb and identify negative experiences that people or even fetuses experience.
And maybe that feeds into why the very nature of Scientology as a religion has been challenged. Stephen Kent, we know that they don't, Scientologists do not like the way you interpret that religion. They, you know, you can go on the web and they've got plenty of critical stuff about you, prejudice for hire and all the rest. But you've made a career of looking into to this practice. And do you come out on balance thinking it's a good thing? Clearly some people like it and feel better in its midst, or a bad thing, and why?
Well, the fact that we have to take seriously individuals who say that they go through some kinds of auditing processes and feel better, whether the subjective feeling of improvement is actually an objective change is a matter of discussion. There's a whole series of organizational issues about the way the organization behaves that are really quite concerning and raise a lot of human rights abuse issues.
Stephen, hold on to those. I want to turn for a moment to Susan Setta with me here in the studio in Boston. Susan, I have the sense that you're a bit more forgiving in your reception of Scientology than Stephen may be. How do you see it? Is it fairly called a religion? You know, it's easy also to go on the web and find people describing it as quackery and cultism. How do you look at it? You're the professor of religion.
Well, the first thing I would say is what I tell my students, and that is when you're looking at another religious tradition, the first thing you need to do is look at your own and make some judgments about your own before you judge the other. Because what can seem very strange to you would also seem strange to other people if they looked at you. So that's a place where I would begin.
I mean, if someone who had never heard the Genesis story in the Old Testament opens a Bible and reads it, it could sound
odd.
A
talking snake, a talking serpent. It would sound very strange. So especially when you're doing the cosmogony, the creation story, it can sound very strange, but you have to say, well, mine isn't exactly straightforward and scientific either, or whatever. The second thing is Paul Tillich defined religion as ultimate concern. And certainly, if you combine that with the view that a religious tradition provides a system of symbols that organize a person's life, and they see everything through that system of symbols, then I would say that Scientology is, of course, a religion. As someone who studies religion as a scholar, I typically take people's word for it if they say that they are religious. And many of the critiques that they're not religious could be wielded at many other groups. So I'm not sure that there's any reason to go there except for the tax code, and I think that
whether or not they deserve the tax-free status.
That's
but
right.
But at a personal level, you're willing to say if you say it's your religion, my friend, it's your religion.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
James Verini, in L.A., in Hollywood, where there's a big center of this, can you perceive a general attitude among adherents of Scientology? Are they defensive? Are they on the offense? Do they feel comfortable professing their Scientology faith in public, or is it something very private?
Well, they certainly feel comfortable professing it. You see them on the street all the time trying to, you know, get you to take personality tests or tour the L. Ron Hubbard Life Exhibition, a museum, a kind of museum on Hollywood Boulevard, which I've done both of those things. Speaking to individual Scientologists who are still members of the church, they are by training and indeed by legal contract, many of them prohibited from speaking much about it, except to explain the most basic stuff that you can learn from Dianetics.
By legal contract, they've signed a contract as part of their membership in the church that prohibits them
from
speaking.
Not all of them have. A lot of them are encouraged to sign. There are various. They have the church has various contracts. Sometimes just involving work that's done. A lot of Scientologists actually work in the church as well. They sign work contracts. The church has a number of covenants that it offers, encourages parishioners to sign, including a very popular billion-year covenant. And then there's also legal release forms, such as the one that was given to members of the church in Florida after the Lisa McPherson case in the 90s, which say basically, I relinquish all control of sort of my mental treatment.
Remind us of the Lisa McPherson case?
I'm sorry?
Remind us of the Lisa McPherson case?
Lisa McPherson, I believe that was her name, was a woman who died in Florida. The professors Kent and Seta will know more about it than I do, but she was a girl who died in Florida, I think in 1995, after extreme dehydration. She was a Scientologist who sort of left, was admitted into a hospital in an extremely distracted state, and then was released from the hospital into the hands of church officials in Clearwater, and then was found dead a few weeks later. Hadn't eaten or had anything to drink in 5 or 10 days, and it was a civil case was brought against the church by her family. After that happened, the church created a legal release form for the members there. I don't know how widely it was used, but it was used for a while. That said, basically, if I'm a Scientologist, I relinquish all sort of clinical treatment to the church. I agree that I will only be treated by the church and not by a hospital or psychologist, and that I can be basically kept from my family or whomever else by the church if the church feels I'm in need of their spiritual treatment.
A big contract to sign. I want to begin to bring our callers in here. Mandy is calling from Boston. Hi, Mandy. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi. What do you know?
I was involved in the Church of Scientology for a little less than a year, and I actually was on the staff of the Church of Scientology for a while. Now, I have left the church fairly recently, and the reason that I left the church, well, let me start by saying my experience was really overwhelmingly positive. The people were the best people I've ever met, extremely charismatic, extremely humanitarian, and I really felt strongly about the gains I was having in Scientology. However, I felt the need to leave after a while because there were contradictions that were inignorable for me.
What kind of contradictions, Mandy?
Well, mainly, I was pretty... I had read a bit about Scientology, quite a bit about Scientology, before I came into the church. So I knew the things, the accusations, all of that. Now, they relieved my fear basically by showing me a quote by L. Ron Hubbard that said, you know, what's true for you is what you experience to be true. Therefore, you can come in here and only accept bits and pieces, only accept what you experience to be true. And in fact, we don't want you to accept anything that you do not fully believe is true.
That's an appealing offer, makes it not intimidating.
Yeah, it really did eliminate the fear, and that in combination with the just nice, completely nice and kind nature of all of these people.
So why are you out now? Why have you left it behind?
I left because that's in direct contradiction for me with the fact that once I was there, I was, you know, expected to, although I am given a choice, but, you know, I was selling Dianetics books. I was saying things like Clear the Planet. There was posters about Clear the Planet everywhere. You were invited to graduations and things.
What does Clear the Planet mean, Mandy?
Oh, I'm sorry. That's in reference to Dianetics. I probably can't get too specific because I'm just not as articulate with it as far as what it really is, and it's pretty complex. But it's just some of the technology involved in Dianetics that I didn't have a complete reality on, and therefore I was not comfortable accepting and disseminating out to people, yet I was kind of expected to do that. But the main contradiction for me was just the money. You're expected to pay to this, or you have to pay in order to get services in the organization, and the money goes to the hole, you know, at least as far as I'm concerned, it goes to the hole. And therefore, that was just a big contradiction that I really couldn't justify to myself.
A lot of money going that way, and now you're out. Mandy, thanks for your call. Stephen Kent, what do you make of Mandy's story?
Scientology requires what it calls fixed donations, but critics call fee for services. And I've talked to some people and their families who have spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on Scientology courses. And when they get finished, they often look back and say, what do I have? There's some significant issues involving money and the long-term involvement of members. And Scientology has been around more or less for 50 years. But I'm not aware, for example, of anything like retirement homes for people who have spent 10, 20, 30 years devoting their lives to Scientology. There's a major concern that as people age, and especially people in the full-time service of Sea Org, and they no longer can produce, they no longer can get the kind of end result Scientology wants. The concern is that they either get sent to Scientology's Rehabilitation Project Force, or they get kicked out of the organization. I haven't seen the kind of long-term thoughtful care that a responsible organization makes to its members who've committed their lives to it.
A lot of facets here, a lot to keep track of. Susan said we've got to take a short break, but I want to get your response as soon as we come back. James Arini, I know we've got to let you go there in L.A. It's been great having you. Let me just ask, on the Tom Cruise front, given the kind of reception he's had, do you expect him to stay so prominent with his Scientology faith?
Actually, could I address one thing that the professor said?
Very quickly, my friend.
Would that be possible?
Yeah, very quickly.
Oh, just very quickly. She compared, the talking serpent or the burning bush to the sort of revealed knowledge in the church. The difference with the Church of Scientology, the difference between that and many, most forms of Christianity, except for like creationism and other literal interpretations, is that in the Church of Scientology, this cosmology with the warlords and so forth is...
Wow, you're going to have to hold it there, James. We'll get it when we come back. Stick with us for a moment. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Scientology buzz. You can't miss it this summer. And what makes a faith a religion? You can join us. What do you think of the Scientology creation story? Is it stranger than your faiths? And why has Scientology had to fight so hard for recognition as a religion? What do you make of Scientology's sharp attacks on psychiatry? And who's to judge what makes a good religion and what's not? We're joined tonight from Madrid, Spain, by Stephen Kent, professor of sociology at the University of Alberta in Canada. With me in the studio, Susan Setta, professor of philosophy and religion at Northeastern University. And with us for another minute here, James Verini with Salon.com in Los Angeles. And James, I'm sorry I had to interrupt you for the break there, but you were drawing a distinction between the biblical creation story or the, I guess we're talking about
right.
The snake in the Garden of Eden and Scientology. Scientology's. Sure, good to have you. But
continue the point. I was just going to say, first of all, there's a fundamental difference between stories that are devised 3,000 years ago and stories that were devised in 1950. Humans generally know a lot more in 1950 than they did, several millennia BC. But the difference is this, with the Bible or the Quran, the vast majority of people take them on different and subtle levels. Only small, subsections of Islam or Christianity, creationists, for instance, take the Bible or the Quran completely literally, what it says. Scientology.
Well, not such a small portion. I mean, you can find an awful lot of people who do, but we'll take that.
The difference is that Scientology is presented to its parishioners on the higher levels, the stuff that's revealed in the OT levels, as scientifically researched fact. L. Ron Hubbard is presented as a one-time archaeologist and one-time astrophysicist, very little of which seems to be true, by the way, who researched these things and found them to be true through archaeology and empirically verifiable, methods of research. And it's presented to the parishioners as such, as fact. And they are shown his handwritten notes and reams of writings.
And here it is, the word of the scientist, and that doesn't sit well with you. We can hear it. James Arini with Salon.com, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Susan said, let me put that to you. James is saying there's a difference. You've got stories from 3,000 years ago and stories from, the 20th century. Stories presented as faith and stories presented as science. Do you see a difference?
Not really. I think everybody thinks that their religious tradition is based in science.
In science?
Sure. If you ask somebody on the street who's a Muslim, what's the relationship between the story of creation in the Quran and the world, and they'll go, oh, it's exactly, he told us exactly what we know now.
But that's perceived as based in truth, but science is kind of a later evolution of human thinking structures, right?
Right, and I think that's one of the places that Scientology is very unique, is that it does stand at the junction of science, psychology, and religion. And because of that, it makes a lot of people uncomfortable. One of the tests of religion is a prophetic religion is how uncomfortable does it make certain elements of our culture? And Scientology, because it's saying that it's combining these, makes the psychologists and the psychiatrists angry. It makes religious groups angry, and it makes science angry as well. But I really don't think there's a significant difference between a religion that is developing now and one that scripture from 3,000 years ago. If you look at any new religions in America, they are giving you the story of how things came to be. If you look at the Latter-day Saints, there are millions of people,
mm-hmm.
right, the Mormons, millions of people believe that Joseph Smith discovered some tablets on a mountain in New York State. And
that described a history that's quite different from what we read in the Bible.
That's right. And many of their people now are going back and trying to show that historically that is true. So the process may be different, but everybody thinks that their creation story is exactly the way it happened and scientifically demonstrable as well.
Stephen Kent, what do you say to that?
Well, the OT creation story plays a very small role in the lives of many Scientologists because they never get to the level of actually hearing and or reading it.
Mm-hmm.
What plays a role are things like auditing, putting into practice Scientology's unique ethics system, putting into practice Scientology's beliefs about psychiatry and medical practice, using what critics say are fees for service.
But let me ask you about those. I mean, you talk about an ethical structure, about auditing, which is a kind of self-awareness, I guess, about money that goes to the church. Of course, money goes to many churches. But you see these in a negative light.
What some government organization in the UK found is that auditing is akin to counseling and that Scientology courses are akin to training, that in fact those techniques are not religious, that if one looks in a practical sense about how these theories translate into human behaviors, what we have to look at is what happens in the real world when a person goes after psychiatry, a person takes Scientology training in lieu of medical training, psychiatric training, and so on. And I'd mentioned the human rights issues. Scientology, in many ways, is a parallel subculture to regular society. Consequently, the organization's behaviors we see in regular society, we see parallels in Scientology.
Such as?
Scientology has its own justice and penal system.
Penal system? Meaning what?
For Sea Org members, these are people who have committed their lives for a period of years to Scientology. If they deviate, if they criticize Scientology leadership, if they have negative thoughts, as indicated by e-meter readings about Scientology leaders, then they are put into a program that can take up to 5 years to be completed.
You mean involuntarily? What does it mean? An ankle bracelet, or just have to attend meetings? What?
Some people say, in retrospect, that they were thrown in involuntarily. When they go in now, so Scientology often covers its tracks by getting people to sign a statement saying that it is voluntary. In that procedure, they work 7 days a week, by policy, 8 hours a day. They get, it looks like, about $12.50 a week for this labor. And then, in addition, they go through extensive Scientology auditing processes, personal confessionals, a lot of social humiliations. They cannot have contact with their normal family members.
You make it sound like a prison re-education camp, but how do they describe
it? Well, it's called the Rehabilitation Project Force, and critics who have been through it use precisely those terms, that it is a, in fact, in print, I've called it a re-indoctrination and brainwashing program.
Let's hear it from our callers again, if we may, Stephen Kent. John's calling from New York City. Hi, John, you're on the air.
Hi. You know, I would say I'm a Scientologist of many years. And,
okay.
Not really interested in arguing my faith, nor am I really interested in arguing with Professor Kent. People like Dr. Lauren Dawson at the University of Waterloo have talked about the methodological flaws and the sorts of problems that Mr. Kent's research has. But let me say this. As a Scientologist, I have personally experienced this, and I urge your listeners not to to trust in radio or television or anything but their own personal experience.
And what have you experienced, John?
I've experienced that Scientology has helped myself and literally hundreds of Scientologists I've met.
In what way?
Let me finish.
Yeah.
The Scientologists I've met, not here, not just here, but in various parts of the world, has helped them lead lives of greater self-respect and respect for others. It has helped people find out how they can help one another from simple things that can become disasters, like a child who can't read, for instance, or a marriage that's falling apart. I've seen marriages put together just again and again and again. And the story of anyone in Scientology will be to tell you about how they use these very useful tools in their lives.
And does it matter to you, John, whether it's called a religion or a counseling system?
Well, it's absolutely a religion. It deals with man as a spiritual being and with his growth. Attempts to deny the religious nature of Scientology just miss things. There are, in fact, as I see it, two views in the world, and one is that man is material, that he's an animal, that his problems have to do with chemical imbalances, and you can cover those up with a drug, and everything will come out okay.
This is what we heard from Tom Cruise.
Well, you know, that I think that he's got something there. When you talk about man as a spirit, and you say each individual has a basic innate worth, and that he is worthy of respect, and that if you help free that person, that he will become more responsible, more loving, healthier, happier.
It's hard to argue with that, and yet some people do. John, we appreciate your call very much. Susan Setta, here we see, you know, John's practiced for many years, he says. It's a positive force in his life. Of course, it's a religion, deals with the spirit. Stephen Kent's drawing distinctions and saying, be careful, it looks more like counseling and not always voluntary counseling even. How do you draw lines through this?
Well, I think there are a couple of points. First, the test of a religion is if it's growing, it has to deliver on its promise. And a group will not survive if it doesn't deliver on its promise. There are thousands of religious groups that last a few hours or a few days. So the fact that this has been around for quite a while and
For how many years now? I mean, half a century,
50,
kind of.
Yeah.
Is that a long time in terms of proving a religion out?
That's a very long time. Some last days.
Okay.
So it has to deliver on its promise. And one of the promises is, and we heard it in L. Ron Hubbard's early statement, that human beings in Scientology are not depraved. There's nothing wrong with them. And they have the ability to heal themselves with the use of Scientology. And you use the E-meter and the auditing to get rid of all kinds of past insults that are hindering you in your life. Professor,
do you have to believe in this scientific efficacy of the E-meter and in eons of prior souls to benefit
ultimately,
from this?
I think you can get different levels. I mean, Mandy wasn't in very long, and she felt that there were benefits to the system.
And yet she's out.
Right. But on the other hand, perhaps she is still able to use some of the techniques that she learned in order to maintain her life in a particularly positive way. The Scientologists would not like to see themselves in the comparison I'm going to make. Scientology actually is attempting to do abreaction, which is a psychoanalytical term where you go back and you relive a painful event in order to get rid of its influence over you.
And they certainly wouldn't like that because they refute
don't.
Psychiatry in
right.
general.
Right.
But you're saying essentially, in your mind, that's what it boils down to.
There's a similarity there. Mm-hmm. And certainly other forms of religion would have a similar technique, that you have to face up to what has happened to you. One of the things is, though, that the human being is good. you are motivated and reacting to things that other people have done wrong to you. But you then are given control over those things that have influenced you.
That's an empowering viewpoint, for
That's
sure.
That's right. And then on the other side of that, and this is where Professor Kent is mentioning the lack of retirement homes, but there is the belief that if everybody gets clear, then no one will hurt anyone. So that there is this vision of a harmonious, just world. So if everyone deals with all the bad stuff within them,
yeah,
then they won't start hurting other people, and ultimately the world will be a better place.
A kind of nirvana on the other side of all that work. I want to get one more call here. Mark is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. I just have a comment. I'd like to mention the fact that Buddhism, which is certainly always considered amongst the world's foremost religion,
yes,
is non-theistic. It does not require any belief in God. Buddha himself refused to address the issue of reincarnation, which was popular in his area with mm-hmm. the religion of the time.
Right.
It simply offers some tools to reach a realization as to the nature of reality.
And if those tools sound unfamiliar or even kooky, depending how you look at it, does that put you off, Mark, or are you willing to say, well, I'll listen?
Well, not at all. I mean, I don't consider myself a Buddhist. I'm not a Scientologist. Buddhism, from what I've seen, appeals to me more than any other religion that I've studied about.
But it's about a system, not necessarily about a God figure. Our time is short, Mark, but we appreciate your call. Stephen Kent, we've just got a minute and a half left here. Take us to your concluding thoughts on Scientology. Is it growing? Is it likely to become recognized ultimately as one of the world's big religions, or is it going to be a marginal player? Is it something that's going to go away?
The Internet has caused big problems for Scientology because now people can go onto the net and find out about Scientology's teachings and behaviors and so on. Moreover, there's real problems in Europe with Scientology's keeping written records, auditing records on members.
What's the problem with that?
Well, apparently in European law there are prohibitions against organizations keeping files on private individuals.
Okay.
And that's exactly what auditing does.
If we come back in 100 years, we've just got half a minute here. Are we going to see Scientology standing alongside the other religions that have lasted the test of time?
No, I don't think so. It will at best remain a small group. And moreover, Scientology does not always represent itself as a religion when it goes into different countries. So even though it may survive in some form, it may appear as a religion in some societies, but as a practical a philosophy of life in others.
Susan said a final thought to you, same question, a century from now. Do you think it's going to be standing there? Will it morph into something else? Is it going to join the pantheon of religions?
Well, yeah, I think yes to all of those. First of all, it survived the transition of the death of its leader. That's a major step in any religious group. Most groups don't survive that. The second piece to that is they have combined evolution with religion. No one else has done that. It can perhaps change, as Professor Kent claims, but I do think it will be with us.
Susan Seda, with Northeast University, thank you for being with us tonight. And Stephen Kent in Madrid, Spain tonight from the University of Alberta in Canada, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.